If you're familiar with the United States Marine Corps, you might be familiar with something called the Crucible. The Crucible is the final test of a Marine recruit's training. It's a 54-hour period. It's during which they get 8 hours of sleep. They have two meals. They do about 48 miles of hiking. They are challenged through many obstacles, many combat simulations, and they're basically ground down into a bit of a pulp. Some of the events that they, some of the combat simulations and the other challenges that they face are held at what they call warrior stations. Now, a warrior station is a location that's usually named after a Marine. Often it's a Medal of Honor recipient. Sometimes it's another notable Marine. But when they get to one of these stations, the drill sergeant will pull out the citation, the Medal of Honor citation or whatever the award citation was, and read the citation and talk about why this individual is being honored here, why this individual received this award, what exactly they did to warrant that honor. And they talk about them. They talk about the merits of these heroes. They talk about their deeds. They talk about the moral strength of what they may have done and what they did. And they share their stories. The Marines aren't alone in this kind of practice. A lot of the special forces operations in the military, they do the same thing. The Navy SEALs have something called Hell Week. Green Berets have an equivalent. They have these activities where a big part of it, ingrained in what they do, they share stories. They talk about the people that went before them. They talk about the heroes, and they talk about their acts, the good things that they did. And those are inspiring to them. Those are part of their identity. Those become ingrained into how they think and why they do what they do. The military isn't alone in sharing stories. We do this culturally. We do this socially. Culturally, we have our hero stories. Sometimes they are real heroes. Sometimes we cultivate heroes. We imagine heroes. We contrive heroes to learn something, to teach something. Because heroes become a part of our identity. Heroes become a part of what we are collectively. Individually, we can identify with them. Collectively, we can identify with them. And they can help bind us together in a sense. I want you to consider how you identify with the following heroes and how everybody else in this room around you might identify with the following heroes. Batman. Some of you may identify, some of you may not. Abraham Lincoln. In our country, I think most of us would identify with Abraham Lincoln as a great man. Jesus Christ. Right? There's more of a commonality. The more we share, the more we identify with one of these heroes, the more we can pull together. They help us pull together because we can all identify with that person. As soon as I say one of those names, you can identify attributes that either you share or that you reject. And as we all share those same attributes, it becomes sort of a shortcut, sort of a shorthand for us to say, yes, that person. I know what that embodies. I know what that means, and I identify with that hero. Why? Why do they pull us together? Why do our heroes help us and bring us together? Because they encourage us, right? Our heroes provide the encouragement to us that what we're trying to achieve is achievable. That's what our heroes do. That's why they're our heroes. They're up there because we know, you and I share certain values and certain things that we're pursuing. And when we share a hero, when we have somebody that we can point to, it's mutually encouraging to both of us to be able to say, yes, we know what he did, and we can follow that. And we can pursue that. Let's turn over to Hebrews 11. You probably figured If you're familiar with Hebrews 11, you probably figured we were going to get there. Hebrews 11 is known commonly as the faith chapter. But I want to give you a little background to Hebrews 11 before we get right into the faith chapter and before we get into this listing of some of the heroes that we see here. Because the writer of Hebrews, which I believe to be Paul, lists out heroes for us. These are our heroes. These are people that we can look to and identify with. People that you say a name like Abraham or Moses. And there are things that you and I immediately identify with and admire and want to emulate. That's a hero. But some background. Why did he write this list? Why do we have this list here? Right? It's great that we have this list. But listen to some of the things that he is encouraging them earlier in the book. I'm going to read you some verses. I'm not going to ask you to turn there. Hebrews 2 and verse 1. Therefore, we must give the more earnest heed to the things that we have heard, lest we drift away. Hebrews 3 and verse 12. Beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. Hebrews 4 and verse 11. Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall according to these same examples of disobedience. Hebrews 10 and verse 23. Let us hold fast to the confession of our hope. In verse 35, therefore do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward, for you have need of endurance. He's talking to a group of people who are struggling. And he's telling them, don't fall away, don't drift away. You've got to endure, you've got to persevere, you've got to hang in there. And he's giving them so much encouragement. He was writing this book probably just before the fall of Jerusalem. You know that Paul died somewhere around 68 AD and Jerusalem fell in 70 AD. And he was writing toward the end of his life and probably writing this to the people in Jerusalem who are under persecution, who are suffering, who are trying to hold up under what's becoming an increasingly compressed situation for them. They're increasingly in conflict with the Romans. And it's becoming increasingly difficult for those Christians who are still right there intertwined with the Jews and treated the same or worse than the Jews by the Romans. Life is getting hard for them. And he's telling them, don't fall away. Don't fall away. He's encouraging them to continue to persevere. And so it's in that context, in the context of encouragement, that he then gets into this chapter on faith. That's where he starts. So he's gone through and he's given them a lot of things. Granted, there's a lot in the book of Hebrews and it's very rich. But one of the themes that you see woven through it constantly is you've got to be diligent about this. You've got to be earnest about this. And so he begins his discourse on faith in chapter 11. Chapter 11 and verse 1. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. We've talked about this in the recent past, that faith isn't just a belief. It's not just something that you hold in your head and you say, yes, I subscribe to this ideal. Faith is much more than that. Faith implies the action that goes with it. Faith implies the living, right? If there isn't living and doing, it's not faith. James teaches us that. We even see Paul teaching us that. That faith requires the action. It requires the diligence. It requires that it's something that must be lived by, not just something that's sort of tucked away and held on to. So it's substance in that sense, that it's action. It's something that's done. It's something that is performed. And notice it's the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. There are so many things about what you and I believe that are not seen. They're not physical things, right? This physical world is just a shadow of the spiritual. And there are so many things that just can't be shadowed in this physical world. And so it's very hard for us to wrap our hands around some of these principles. Right? How do you make righteousness a tangible thing? How do you make eternal life a tangible thing? We have a hard time grasping eternity. Right? There are all of these things that are not tangible. They're not real to us. Faith is real. Faith is substance. Because it's something that's inside of you. It's something that burns in you and compels you to act and to do something. One of our booklets, it says it simply this way: the faith required to be justified must be confirmed in one's actions. Right? It's something that is confirmed, it's lived by. So it's that fire that burns hot. It's something that it can't help but drive how you think and what you do. It's just there. It's in you and it's burning. And your thoughts are driven that way. Your actions are driven that way because it's what you are. You're on fire about it. What fuels that fire? What is it that fuels that fire of faith? Drop down a few verses because he gives us the answer there. And I believe one of the big points he's making in chapter 11 here is directly related to what he tells us in verse 6. Hebrews 11 and verse 6 says, "Without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him." There are two basic components of faith that he's describing here. You have to believe that God exists. That seems pretty fundamental. Right? If you don't believe that God exists, you know, what are you really doing? What are you really doing here? Feeling some things out, maybe checking some things out, right? But if you don't actually believe that God exists, then none of this is going to be meaningful. So that seems pretty fundamental. It's the next part that I really want to focus on today. It says that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. We heard a lot about this in the first message. We have to be focused on him. We have to be seeking him. We have to have our mind set on him and our thoughts set on him. Right? Diligently seeking is a very active thing, isn't it? But notice that it says he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. He rewards those who pursue him, who are focused on him, who come after him. Let's keep in mind the difference between a reward and a goal. We've talked about this here in years past. The reward and the goal are different things. If you're running a race, right, your goal is to finish the race. It's to cross the finish line. That's your goal. You want to get there. Whatever sport you're playing, right, you have certain goals that you're trying to achieve. Those are different from the rewards, right? If you're in the Olympics and you win a race, your goal, which was completing the race to be first ahead of everybody else, you might be rewarded with a medal or with money or with endorsements, right? There are different rewards for winning different races. The reward is different than the goal. Our goal is to be like God, is to have his mind, is to think like him. But he tells us that he rewards us. When we finish our race, when we run that race, he has a reward for us. And he's telling us here that it's not wrong for us to want that. Sometimes I think we hesitate a little bit. We don't want to seem so, you know, selfish and self-focused that, oh, I'm just in this to get this, to get something out of this, which we shouldn't be. We shouldn't be just in this to get something out of it, right? Again, that would be making the reward your goal. That's not what we're here to do. Our goal is to become like God. But we can be excited and should be excited, and I think we'll be able to demonstrate that here. We should be excited about this reward. This reward is what fuels that fire. This reward fueled the fire of the people that we see here, of our heroes. And we see it in their examples. I'd like to go through that today because I think seeing that God is a rewarder, it says that this is just as fundamental as believing that He is believing that He rewards those who are seeking Him. This is a fundamental component of faith. We have to believe it. We have to internalize it in the same sense that we internalize that God exists. Believing that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him ties hand in hand with the idea that God has your best interest in mind at all times. He always has your best interest at heart. Whatever it is that you're going through, whatever it is that you're experiencing, if you fundamentally believe that God is a rewarder of those who are seeking Him, then you know that He is going to reward you for this. That whatever the trial is, whatever it is you're facing up against, He has a reward on the other side. He might even have some sort of reward that you get to see a little part of in this life. And that's all part and parcel of believing that He rewards those who seek Him. This is a fundamental part of our faith. And we have some examples. So let's look at some of these examples because they're pretty exciting. I'd like to start in verse 8. We don't have time to go through all of them. We could spend a long, long time going through each one of them. But let's start with Abraham in Hebrews 11 and verse 8. It says, by faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. Let's turn over to Genesis 12 and verse 1. Let's see this. Genesis chapter 12 and verse 1. You can keep your bookmark in Hebrews 11. We'll be back there. Genesis 12 and verse 1, it says, now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in all the families of the earth, in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abram departed, as the Lord had spoken to him. And Lot went with him, and he was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. This was a big deal for him to pick up and take off and go. I'd like to read an excerpt from a book by Thomas Cahill called The Gifts of the Jews. He has this comment that he makes on this verse. So Avram went, Yalach Avram. He says these are two of the boldest words in all literature. They signal a complete departure from everything that has gone before in the long evolution of culture and sensibility. Out of Sumer, the civilized repository of the predictable, comes a man who does not know where he is going, but goes forth into the unknown wilderness of the prompting of his God. Out of Mesopotamia, the home of the canny, self-serving merchants who used their gods to ensure prosperity and favor, comes a wealthy caravan with no material goal. Out of ancient humanity, which from the dim beginnings of its consciousness had read its eternal verities in the stars, comes a party traveling by no known compass. Out of the human race, which knows in its bones that all its striving must end in death, comes a leader who says he has been given an impossible promise. He was given a promise. And out of, he says, mortal imagination, I would say out of faith, comes a dream of something new, something better, something yet to happen, something in the future. A reward. Abraham was coming out of a world that was focused on the cyclical nature of life and death. Everything that had happened is what would happen before. Don't try and alter fate, because everything was just going through this circle of life. And here he comes out with this idea that man might have some sort of other purpose, that God has some other purpose for man. And he picks up and he leaves everything that he knows. This was completely foreign to the world of his day. He picked up and he left. It was an act of faith, and it's called out as an act of faith. But notice what he was doing. Notice what he was pursuing. Let's go back to Hebrews 11 and verse 8. He went out, not knowing where he was going. But it says in verse 8, he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. So he knew that there was an inheritance out there. Verse 9, by faith he dwelt in the land of promise, as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. He saw something that was not physical. He saw a reward. He was focused on that reward, and that reward fueled a lot of his actions. The idea, the promise of that reward caused him to pick up and leave everything that he knew and pursue something completely different. This isn't very different than what you and I are called to do in a spiritual sense. We're called to pick up and leave everything that seems normal, that seems right by this world, by this world's standards, by this world's way of thinking. We're called to pick up and leave all of that and have this totally different mind, this totally different way of thinking about things, and pursue that. And we're told to do this on faith, in faith, looking to a reward for doing it. We know that there's a reward. And God promises that reward if we endure, if we persevere, if we spend our whole life pursuing this and pursuing it diligently. The only recorded possession that we ever see that Abraham had in Canaan was a plot to bury his wife. That's all that we really know he ever owned. He never had that physical promise fulfilled. He was promised the whole land of Canaan. He was promised heirs. And he died only having one, really. But he knew the promise, and he saw what was ahead. And to him, it was real. It was real and it was tangible. And he had faith and trusted in it. He knew that God rewards those who diligently seek him. That was what was underneath it all. He understood this principle. This core basic principle of faith. If we diligently seek God, he will reward us. Let's go over to Hebrews 11 and verse 20. We should still be there. Hebrews 11 and verse 20. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. One small, simple sentence. But it says, by faith, Isaac blessed them. There's something about this blessing that was an act of faith. Let's go back and read it. If you go to Genesis chapter 27. Turn back to Genesis 27 and verse 27. Now we know that Jacob tricked his father Esau, or Jacob tricked his father Isaac into thinking that he was Esau, because Isaac loved Esau more than Jacob. So Jacob dresses up as Esau, makes himself smell like Esau and feel like Esau, and he comes in to Isaac and he says, bless me, father. And Isaac is unaware of this. And so he blesses him. Verse 27. Surely the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Therefore, may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be a master over your brethren, and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you. We see a similar prayer. In verse 39, here Esau comes in a little late, as we know. And Esau comes in and asks for a blessing and says, please bless me also, Father. So Isaac prays again. He says, "Behold, your dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth, and of the dew of heaven from above. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. And it shall come to pass, when you become restless, that you shall break his yoke from your neck." We see, obviously, the better blessing given to Jacob and the lesser to Esau. But notice over in chapter 28, we kind of think, well, there's the story. One got the one blessing and Esau got the other. That's not it, though. Isaac did come around to intentionally blessing his son Jacob. We see that blessing in chapter 28 and verse 3. He says, "May God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may be an assembly of peoples, and give you the blessing of Abraham to you and your descendants with you, that you may inherit the land in which you are a stranger, which God gave to Abraham." Now, we read these, and we read these in the context of the Bible, thinking, oh, okay, well, he's speaking, and he sounds like he's saying something prophetic here, and he's telling the future and what it's going to be, and we have sort of these maybe imaginations of God providing him some sort of inspiration and some sort of, maybe God gave him a vision of what he was going to see in the future and what it was that was to come. And we can sort of craft that sort of idea around what we read here, because what he says here is so unnatural. If you or I are praying for somebody else, we don't necessarily come at it like this, right? But Hebrews 11 tells us that this was an act of faith. This was an act of trust that he knew that God, again, God rewards those who diligently seek him. He understood that God was going to reward him, that God was going to reward him because of Abraham. He's praying here for the blessings of Abraham to be on his sons. And this is an act of faith in the sense that I don't believe that he actually knew that all of this was going to transpire. He's coming at this and saying, "May God do this." You see, if you go back and you read these things, a lot of it is saying, "Let God, let people serve you and nations bow down to you, and let your mother's sons bow down to you." He's saying, "Let all of this happen. May God make all of this happen." And he trusted that God would have all of these things happen because he knew that God rewards. He understood that there was something greater, that there were promises that had been made to his father that needed to be fulfilled to his offspring. And so he's looking here to the future and to the promises that were to be given. And his prayers here, in that sense, are an act of faith. I can't imagine saying a prayer like this and having the same sort of confidence that Isaac must have had when he was praying this over his sons. This was an act of faith, these prayers were. And we're told that. Let's go back to Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11 and verse 21 and verse 22, we see similar things said about Jacob and Joseph. "By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning on the top of his staff." Again, we can go back and read the story about how Jacob blessed Ephraim and Manasseh. He blessed them. And when he did that, he intentionally crossed his hands, laying his right hand on the head of the younger one and laying his left hand on the head of the older one. Because he said, "No, this one's going to be greater." How did he know that? This was an act of faith. It tells us right here in Hebrews, this was an act of faith. He understood that God rewards, that God does these amazing things, that God has these things planned for his people and made promises to his offspring. "By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones." So we're told that Joseph also, he looked forward to the reward. He looked forward to the things that God had promised and knew and was fully confident that those things would happen. And so he acted on it. These are all acts of faith. Let's read about Moses in verse 23. "By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents. This is an act of faith by his parents, because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. We get a little bit of insight here into Moses' life that we don't necessarily have recorded in the Old Testament. We see that he opted out of certain blessings and certain luxuries and certain benefits because he understood that diligently seeking God was more important. And he put that as his priority. And he understood, as we'll see here in the next verse, that there was something on the other side. Verse 26, he esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. We're told that Moses, the meekest man in all of the earth, Moses was looking to that reward. He was excited about that reward. His excitement over that reward, his value that he placed on that reward, was so great that he was willing to blow off all of these other great things that he could have had as a prince of Egypt. And he put them all aside and said, I'm not going to have anything to do with that. And instead, I'm going to go be with the slave people and lead them out of this place. This is an act of faith. Again, fueled by the idea of that reward, fueled by something that was afar off. In verse 35, we see stories about others. It says others. And it doesn't tell us specifically who they are, but it says others in verse 35. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. A lot of the commentaries believe that the torturing described here, the mockings, the scourgings, they're describing some of the things that happened during the Maccabean Rebellion. The book of Maccabees is largely a historical document. It tells about the Maccabean Rebellion before Christ's time. And some of the things that the people, the Jews of that day, suffered and endured for the sake of God's law, for holding fast to God's law. I said people held on through all of that and endured some terrible things. And he says, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. The implication of the language here being that the chains and imprisonment are even worse, or were even worse. You go back and you read some of the stories. In Jeremiah 38, you can read about Jeremiah's imprisonment. And it's not a real long story, but when you think about what he actually endured, it's pretty terrible. They essentially lowered him down into a cistern. Cistern's a really deep hole in the ground. And at that point, the cistern was mostly dried up. And so there's just thick sort of sludge in the bottom of the cistern. Josephus says that he was in it up to his neck. The Bible doesn't call that out, but he was lowered down into it by ropes, and they basically wanted to leave him there to die. They may have even rolled a stone over the top of the cistern so that he was down in the bottom of this pit in complete darkness for days, it appears, before someone reported it to the king and went and got him out. But you imagine being imprisoned in something like that for days, thinking you're basically just left there to die. It's a pretty terrible fate. It tells us these people endured these things because they had a hope in them. They had a focus. They had something that they were so excited about in the future. They knew that there was a reward. And for them, that reward was worth so much that all of this, yes, it was difficult. But for them, it was worth persevering. It was worth enduring. Hebrews 11, verse 13. This is right in the middle, but it's really describing what these people did and why they did it. It says, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them. They were sure. They were confident in them because they knew, again, they knew that God is a rewarder of those who seek him. And so they were assured of that. They understood that. They knew that there was a reward out there, and they embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. This is their focus. This needs to be our focus. This is the thing, the reward in there is all bound up in this city that he has prepared for us. There's a city, there's a place he has for us, a position he has for us, eternal life he has prepared for us, a crown that he has for you, a new name for you. He has all of these things that he describes that he has ready for us, waiting for us. He doesn't tell us about them because he wants us to sort of say, oh, that's going to be really good for everybody else. No, he wants us to be excited about them. He has them for you and wants them for you. Imagine if you have an amazing gift that you bought for someone and you want to give to somebody, right? You want them to be excited about it. You want them to be on fire about it, right? Especially if it's a reward for something. We recently rewarded my son. He recently learned to go to the bathroom. This is a big deal. He's almost three. But he recently learned to go to the bathroom. Now, we bought him a toy. We bought him a set of Duplo. If you know what Duplo are, if you don't, they're like big Legos. We bought him a Duplo set with one of his favorite characters. And we put it up right out smack middle of the living room so that he could see it every day. And we wanted him to be excited about it, right? There were times that he wasn't as excited as we wanted him to be about it. But this was a reward for something that we wanted him to do. And we wanted him to be excited. And so we really made a big deal out of it, to the point that he was excited and he was on fire for it. And it probably helped him. He did a good job. He just got it this week. Right, he just earned that. But we wanted him to be excited for it. God wants us to be excited about what he's prepared for us. It says he's not ashamed of it. He's not ashamed to be called our God. He's prepared this wonderful thing. Hebrews 12 and verse 1. It says, therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Let's finish it. Let's hit that goal, because there is a reward for finishing that race. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despised the shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Jesus Christ is set up as our ultimate hero. There's this list that we have here, but he's identified as our supreme hero. He's the one, of course, that we look to and emulate in all things. All the others in this list, they have some flaws. They have some problems. Paul is very gracious in glossing over those problems. There are some people in this list that you might look at and say, why is that guy there? Paul glosses over those things because he's focusing on their faith. He's focusing on what they were looking toward, on their confidence in that reward that God offered. Jesus Christ is the ultimate example of that. He understood the reward. He knew the prize. The prize for him was very different. The prize for him was all of us. And that was very exciting for him. And he endured and stuck it out to the end. If you want to grow in faith, which I assume you do, which I do, go learn the stories of our heroes. Go back and read through them. This list only scratches the surface, and Paul knows it. Right? If you look at verse 32, he says, "What more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith they did all of these things." He gives this list of people and he says, "I don't have time to talk about all of them. And I don't have time to talk about all of them either." But we do. We have time to go back. And if you want to grow in faith, go back and learn these stories. He lists some of them. He goes through and skims the surface and picks out some of them. There are some that he doesn't list at all. There are people like Hezekiah, Jehoshaphat, Hosea, Jeremiah, Job. You go back and you read the stories of some of these people, and you'll see that these were people of faith. These are our heroes. You and I are not so different from the people in the book of Hebrews. Right? We have the same kinds of trials, the same kinds of problems. Our society can sort of wear us down, right? It can get heavy on you. Which is why we need to, again, be looking to God. We need to look to what He's set out before us. He gives us His book and He fills it with all of these examples of people who did good things that He praises and He applauds. And He sets them up as our heroes. We're like the people in the book of Hebrews in the sense that great tribulation could be imminent. The destruction of Jerusalem and persecution was right over the horizon for them. We don't know what's right over the horizon for us. But we're sitting here in this time where it can start to wear down at us and give us troubles and weigh heavy on us. So we need to take courage. We need to take courage in this cloud of witnesses that we have, in these heroes that we have. Let's learn their stories. Let's identify with them. And let's have that reward set clearly in our minds so that flame of faith that burns in us can burn and burn bright.